Iran's ambassador to the UN says Israel's allegations against his country's nuclear program are aimed at covering up the threats posed by the regime's nuclear weapons. The British Defense Secretary says probes into claims of abuse by British troops in Iraq have closed without any prosecutions being brought. Also, mounting tensions on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea says it has test-fired a new ballistic missile from a submarine. Our top story this hour, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has dismissed Israel's allegations against Tehran's nuclear program as unfounded and irrelevant. Majid Takht Ravanchi said Israel is trying to play the victim in a bid to divert the attention of the international community from its crimes against Palestinian people. He said the regime's accusations are also aimed at covering up the threat that its nuclear weapons pose to the world. Takht Ravanchi was speaking at a UN Security Council meeting. This came after Israel's ambassador accused Iran of trying to become a nuclear threshold state. Gilad Erdan also raised the possibility of a military attack against the Islamic Republic. Iran has time and again warned that it will give a crushing response to any acts of aggression against the country. Author and journalist Daniel Lazar believes Israel's threats to launch military action against Iran are a travesty of international law.
Israel has 200 or more nuclear warheads. It is not a signatory to the Nuclear Arms Anti-Proliferation Treaty. It does not abide by any international agreements regarding nuclear arms at all. Yet it claims the unilateral right to restrict Iran from engaging in any kind of nuclear enrichment program of its own, and threatens it with military attack if Iran threatens to do so. So it just makes no sense at all. It's a classic case of the strong making law, to benefit their own side. It's just a complete travesty of anything resembling international good faith negotiations.
An energy crunch fueled by a supply-demand imbalance is quickly gripping the world as the cold season approaches. However, the crisis and the ordeal can be eased if Iran's oil is allowed back into the international market. We have more in this report.
Winter is coming, and from the looks of things, it will be a long, harsh, and very cold one. But at the same time, the world is in the midst of an unprecedented energy crisis, with dire economic, social, and political ramifications. Brent crude has surged to a five-year high of over $80 per barrel, while gas prices are up over 500% year on year. The International Energy Agency says the global energy crunch is expected to boost oil demand by about 500,000 barrels a day. Analysts say the energy crisis is rooted in soaring demand as the economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic takes hold, and the production level has simply failed to keep up with demand. However, some immediate measures could easily resolve this crisis. One such fix would be the removal of US sanctions on Iran, which enjoys one of the largest hydrocarbon reserves in the world. The flow of Iranian oil into the global market, for example, would be vital in easing the crisis.
Until a couple of months ago, it was not very important for the world that Iran is under sanctions because supply exceeded demand. But the current trends in the global market may put pressure on consumer countries, Europeans and countries like India and China or U.S. allies to push Washington to lift sanctions.
Iran has repeatedly underlined its ability to swiftly increase its crude production to help alleviate the global shortage. Its oil minister recently said people in the United States and some European countries are paying the price for their leaders' unwise policies. Javad Oji stressed that Iran on several occasions displayed its goodwill to help stabilize the oil market and resolve the global energy crisis. But U.S. sanctions are standing in the way. People in Lebanon, who have been facing gasoline and diesel shortages and electricity blackouts, bear witness that ways are found where there is mutual will. Iran has recently been delivering shipments of fuel to energy-starved Lebanon, despite U.S. sanctions targeting both countries. That was achieved through through the determination of both Iran and the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah. Iran had also earlier dispatched fuel shipments all the way to Venezuela. Now, as millions of people around the globe are bracing for a hard and long winter, it's worthwhile to ask how much of the ordeal could be averted through a similar international resolve.
The UK Defense Secretary says investigations into British troops' alleged abuses in Iraq have closed without a single prosecution being brought. Ben Wallace said thousands of allegations against British troops serving in Iraq between 2003 and 2009 were looked into, adding that no soldiers were prosecuted. Wallace said a body investigating the allegations is, quote, officially closed its doors. He, however, stressed that some shocking and shameful incidents did happen in Iraq. The Defense Secretary did not elaborate about those incidents. The allegations investigated were about Iraqi civilians' claims of serious criminal behavior from British armed forces. The spokesman for the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says 10,000 Yemeni children have been killed or maimed since the start of the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
The Yemen conflict has just hit another shameful milestone. We now have 10,000 children have been killed or maimed since fighting commenced in March of 2015. That's the equivalent of 4 children every single day. These, of course, are the numbers that the United Nations can verify. Many more child deaths and injuries go unreported to all but, of course, family members.
James Elder made the revelation during a UN briefing in Geneva after returning from Yemen. He said a total of 11 million children need humanitarian assistance, while 400,000 of them are suffering from severe acute malnutrition. The UNICEF spokesperson also noted that nearly 2 million children have been displaced due to the war and that the number is increasing. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The years-long war has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians. The country is now struggling with what the UN describes as the worst humanitarian crisis. North Korea says it has successfully test-fired a new type of submarine-launched ballistic missile. North Korean media say the weapon was equipped with advanced control guidance technologies. They say the missile was fired from the same vessel used in its first such test 5 years ago. Earlier, South Korea's military reported a similar occurrence, noting that the missile was fired toward the sea. The recent launch from the North follows Washington's renewed calls for talks with Pyongyang. The U.S. and its regional allies have been expressing concern about the North's missile tests. Last week, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, however, described the United States as the root cause of instability on the Korean Peninsula. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, says the latest missile test by North Korea is considered as the most powerful demonstration of Pyongyang's military might since Joe Biden took office as the U.S. president.
Now, this is considered to be the most powerful demonstration of North Korea's military might since the new U.S. president, Joe Biden, took office, because this is a submarine-launched ballistic missile that the North can send to near the coastline of the U.S. mainland while evading all U.S. missile defenses and basically destroy any U.S. city with a nuclear-tipped ballistic missile on such a submarine. So now the North has done 4 tests just last month, and this is the most dangerous one of them all to the U.S. And this is causing the U.S. to be under pressure, even more pressure than it was after the 4 tests last month than it was then. And right now, the U.S. is just in a flurry of diplomatic activity. The U.S. nuclear envoy for North Korea, Sung Kim, met with his Japanese and South Korean counterparts in Washington this week, and he is going to come to South Korea, to Seoul, to meet with his South Korean counterpart again to try to jumpstart stalled negotiations with North Korea.
Hundreds of non-local workers are fleeing Indian-controlled Kashmir after they were targeted by a series of shooting incidents. Since the beginning of October, more than 30 people, including Indian armed personnel, civilians, and pro-freedom fighters, have been killed across the troubled Himalayan region. Our correspondent, Shahana Bhatt, reports from Kashmir.
Fear is growing in Indian-controlled Kashmir following a series of shooting incidents across the region that killed around a dozen civilians, including four non-local workers. The fear doubled among the non-local residents after police said non-locals should reach army camps and police stations. Vananjit Kumar has been working in Kashmir for the last 12 years. Each year he stays here for 6 months and returns home with his hard-earned money. But this year, he's moving ahead of time.
My family back home is worried. They insisted upon my return. I have worked for so many years here, but I have never seen such chaos. The situation here has never been right, but we were never involved. This time, it's different.
Dhananjit Kumar and many like him are on the move, while many others have sought police protection till they manage a way out. Following the deadly October violence in Kashmir that resulted in more than 33 killings, which included 9 Indian Army personnel, 11 civilians, and 13 pro-freedom fighters in different incidents, the administration issued an alert across the war-weary Indian-administered Kashmir. Intelligence reports warn of attacks on power projects, emergency landing strips, and other government infrastructure. New Delhi has installed additional security forces across Kashmir after intelligence reports warned of more attacks.
We are doing our best to neutralize the terrorists who are behind the civilian killings. We have killed around 11 terrorists in October till now, and we'll do our best to ensure the safety and security of our people. It's not a security lapse. The targets were soft, and now we beefed up and more vigilant.
After India stripped Kashmir's autonomous status in August 2019, people of the region were promised development, prosperity, and greater opportunities. However, media reports suggest the situation in the region has slipped from bad to worse due to the absence of local political activities and implementation of rules and laws without taking people of Kashmir on board. Kashmir is a dispute between India and Pakistan since the partition of Indian subcontinent in 1947. The two have fought wars over the territory and claimed the region in full, but rule it in parts.
The fresh spate of violence in Indian-administered Kashmir is seen by many as a politically motivated action. People of Kashmir urge the world community to help resolve this geopolitical dispute between India and Pakistan before they engage in war and devastate the leftover lives. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The European Union's executive president and Poland's prime minister clashed during a debate in the European Parliament over Warsaw's alleged rule of law breaches. The European Commission accuses the Polish government of eroding judicial independence and media freedoms. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
On Tuesday, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen greeted Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki at the beginning of a five-hour debate in the European Parliament. The niceties didn't last long.
Don't try to divert. That's the debate right now here about the rule of law and the primacy of European law. Don't try to run away and to escape that debate.
Morawiecki insists Poland's constitution has primacy over EU law, and this is infuriating the bloc's establishment. Amongst other things, EU authorities are worried the Polish government is trampling on fundamental rights, judicial independence, and freedom of the press. Morawiecki insists hypocrisy is at play when rule of law is debated.
Some member states maintain tax havens. It means that in the EU, the richest member states are making even more money. How is this part of our EU values?
Criticism towards Morawiecki kept on coming, however.
For years, you have been infecting the minds of Polish people with lies and manipulation about European rules and regulations.
The Polish Prime Minister raised a myriad of issues, ranging from the EU's energy crisis to the refugee situation, but the focus repeatedly came back to him. Analysts say the EU is in no position to preach about rule of law in the light of its treatment of minority groups in the bloc, such as refugees. The problem has become worse due to recent developments in Afghanistan.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
Inside the chamber, Morawiecki was criticised over his country's treatment of refugees, but he certainly was not without his supporters. Lawmakers want the European Commission to withhold billions of euro in funding to Poland, but that could be a lengthy process. When the Commission initiates proceedings against a member state, it normally takes many years before there is a conclusion to the case. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Muslims in Nigeria have filled the streets of the capital, Abuja, to mark the birthday anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad. Danjuma Abdullahi has this report from Abuja.
Thousands of Muslims marched through major streets of Suleja to mark the birthday anniversary of Prophet Muhammad. For members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, the celebration has been going on for a week because it was designated as the Unity Week by the late founder of the Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini.
We all believe that the Prophet is our Prophet, one Prophet, no any other Prophet apart from him. And he unites, he brought the Quran through Archangel Jibril, and he is the one that shows us the path, the direction, and way to follow. The whole people in this town are now out to celebrate the birthday without any of us thinking that he will be paid.
Members of the Islamic movement said Muslims must unite to defeat the seeds of discord planted by enemies of Islam in the name of Shia-Sunni sectarian divide. They condemned the various terror attacks resulting in the killing of Muslims in Afghanistan and in Nigeria, which they said may not be unconnected with global arrogance to plunge the Muslim communities into chaos in order to steal resources. These incidents, the Islamic movement said, is the result of disunity. So Muslims around the world must unite. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria recall that their leader, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki, has always emphasized that unity among Muslims is about understanding each other and working together for the benefit of the larger Islamic Ummah. They say that although this is an auspicious occasion, it is important to recall the 2015 Zaria massacre, where more than 347 of their members were killed. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Joe Biden is not the first president to invoke the state secrets privilege in the so-called War on Terror. The Bush administration used the privilege to evade accountability for torture, to silence whistleblowers, and prevent disclosure of its extraordinary rendition program. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Marjorie Kahn, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden tells Supreme Court that publicly documented torture is a state secret. Stay tuned for more. When Abu Zubaydah was apprehended in Pakistan in 2002, the George W. Bush administration falsely characterized him as chief of operations for Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden's number three man. For the next 4 years, the CIA sent Zubaydah to its black sites in Thailand and Poland, where he was viciously tortured. In 2006, Zubaydah was taken to Guantanamo, where he remains to this day. He has never been charged with a crime. The torture of Abu Zubaydah is thoroughly documented in the 2014 report of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. In fact, several of the justices at the October 6th Supreme Court oral argument in
United States versus Zubaydah referred to his treatment as torture. Zubaydah's lawyers detailed the torture he suffered in their brief, which referenced the Senate torture report as follows. On 83 different occasions in a single month of 2002, he was strapped to an inclined board with his head lower than his feet, while CIA contractors poured water up his nose and down his throat, bringing him within sight of death. He was handcuffed and repeatedly slammed into walls and suspended naked from hooks in the ceiling for hours at a time. He was forced to remain awake for 11 consecutive days and douse again and again with cold water when he collapsed into sleep. He was forced into a tall, narrow box the size of a coffin and crammed into another box that would nearly fit under a chair, where he was left for hours. He was subjected to a particularly grotesque humiliation described by CIA as rectal rehydration. Nevertheless, the Biden administration told the High Court that Zubaydah's well-known torture is a state secret because former CIA Director Mike Pompeo said publicizing it would harm national security. Thus, Solicitor General Brian Fletcher argued the two contractors who orchestrated Zubaydah's torture in Poland should not be permitted to testify in a Polish court's criminal investigation into the treatment of Zubaydah. But as Justice Elena Kagan said, at a certain point, it becomes a little farcical. This idea of the assertion of a privilege, doesn't it? I mean, if everybody knows what you're asserting privilege on, like what exactly does this privilege, it's not a state secret privilege anymore. Ultimately, the question in this case is whether torture can be kept secret. In a democracy, the answer to that question has to be no. Attorney Joseph Margulis, who represents Zubaydah, told Truth Out, adding, the state secrets doctrine must never be used to prevent an accounting for torture done in our name. If secrets means protect torture, before long we won't have a state to protect. The Biden administration seeks to prevent testimony of psychologists James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who have already testified in a prior case and in the military commission at Guantanamo. Mitchell and Jessen were the chief architects of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques, the U.S. government's euphemism for torture. They were paid more than $80 million for their vile work. Continuing Donald Trump's attempts to thwart the psychologist's testimony, the Biden administration claims that if Mitchell and Jessen admit Zubaydah was tortured at the CIA black site in Poland, it will create a breach of trust with the Polish government. The Polish prosecutor already has information that it happened in Poland and doesn't need U.S. discovery on the topic, David Klein, Zubaydah's attorney, told the justices, adding, what he does need to know is what happened inside Abu Zubaydah's cell between December 2002 and September 2003. So I want to ask simple questions like, how was Abu Zubaydah fed? What was his medical condition? What was his cell like? And yes, was he tortured? After the Supreme Court engaged in an extensive back-and-forth exchange about the parameters of the state secrets privilege, Justices Stephen Breyer, Neil Gorsuch, and Sonia Stomeyer all insisted that Zubaydah himself, who was an eyewitness to his torture, should be allowed to testify instead of the psychologist at the Polish proceeding. That would circumvent the state secrets issue, they noted. Gorsuch called it an off-ramp to avoid additional litigation. Klein said Abu Zubaydah cannot testify because he is being held incommunicado. He has been held in Guantanamo incommunicado. Why? Why? Breyer said, astounded that Zobeida is still being held in Guantanamo after 15 years. In Hamdi, we said you could hold people in Guantanamo. The words for active combat operations against Taliban fighters apparently are going on in Afghanistan. Well, they're not anymore, unquote. Brett Kavanaugh asked Fletcher, is the United States still engaged in hostilities for purposes of the AUMF, that is, Authorization for Use of Military Force Against Al-Qaeda and Related Terrorist Organizations? Fletcher replied, that is the government's position, that notwithstanding the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan, we continue to be engaged in hostilities with Al-Qaeda, and therefore the detention under law of war remains proper, unquote. Kavanaugh and Fletcher apparently overlooked the fact that the CIA later concluded that Abu Zubaydah was not a member of Al-Qaeda, according to the state torture report. And the AUMF that Congress gave Bush after 9/11 only authorized the president to use military force against those groups and individuals responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Joe Biden is not the first president to invoke the state secrets privilege in the so-called War on Terror. The Bush administration used the privilege to evade accountability for torture, to silence whistleblowers, and prevent disclosure of its extraordinary rendition program, where the CIA sent people, including Abu Zubaydah, to other countries to be tortured. Bush's assertion of the privilege did not, however, succeed in keeping the publicly acknowledged National Security Agency surveillance program secret. The Obama administration invoked the privilege to block judicial inquiry into extraordinary rendition. It also used the privilege to hide Barack Obama's kill list that authorized the CIA and the Defense Department to kill civilians with no showing of imminent threat. And the Trump administration utilized the privilege in Zubaydah's case in another torture case, as well as to preclude release of an FBI report about Saudi complicity in 9/11 attacks. Will the Supreme Court accept Biden's assertion of the state secrets privilege to prevent testimony of Mitchell and Jessen in the Polish court? Will the court urge the executive branch to allow Zubaydah to testify about his torture at the CIA's black site in Poland? Will the court suggest that the executive reconsider the indefinite detention of Zubaydah in the light of U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan? We will know by June 2022. This case is a pivotal test of the willingness of the Supreme Court to check and balance the executive when it perpetrates torture and other war crimes in its so-called war on terror. In 2016, Margulis said that Abu Zubaydah is the poster child for the torture program, and that's why they never want him to be heard from again.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners. On the occasion of Islamic Unity Week that spans the two dates of Rabiul Awwal, that is 12 and 17, which are marked respectively as the birthday of the Seal of Messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, we present you a statement from our beloved Prophet, which is so essential for unity and solidarity of the Ummah. Regard my Ahlul Bayt as the head is to the body and the eyes are to the head. because the body would not be guided except by the head, and the head cannot be guided except by the eyes.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. Humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the eyes of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, wa Sayyid al-Muwahideen, Mawlaya Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he looks at life, one of the first things that he looks at is the concept of death. And when he looks at the concept of death, he doesn't look at it as a concept or as a thing that should bring pain, sorrow, and I don't know, depression to a person. In fact, on the contrary, since life is short and since we will die, so Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi says, you don't have enough time, which means you need to work, you need to create a civilization, you need to create a better world, not vice versa, not that you spend your time in entertainment, in wasting time and passing time. Because your time is short, you have a mission to accomplish in this world. This is not the time for us to have fun, not the time for us to enjoy ourselves. We will get that, inshallah, once we die, if we go to heaven. But for this life, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah says, since death is there, so you need to work as hard as you can, as much as you can, make as much use of your time as you can. So that becomes a basis for us to initiate life itself and to embed the foundations and the pillars to to respecting the rights of other people, to leave hatred aside, to become more generous, to become more giving, you know, to have such moral values and neglect moral vices like pride and oppression and all these things, because this is not the time for it, right? Amir Amin says, that is not the time for this. Do good, be good, because your time is limited, your time is short. So according to the Alawi thinking, the Alawi way of life, he wants life to have more value, right? And that value should overtake death itself. Because sometimes even him, Amir al-Mu'min, he's been martyred over 1400 years ago. Yet he still lives and echoes through history and through ages. And he will until the day of judgment. Why? Because he did not give himself the chance to, you know, waste time, act in vain, entertain himself. He was working for humanity, for the betterment of humanity, for establishing human rights. And those values that he worked for, they overtaken death itself. For Ali alayhi salam is always alive, right? So that's how we should work in the same way as Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi. Amongst the things that he fought for and he stood for, preserving the life of a human being. And he says that no one has a right to take a right of another person. Even he says in a quote, he says, Al-Kaba'aru al-Kufru billah, the major sins to deny Allah's existence, and وَقَتْلُ النَّفْسِ, to kill another human soul. So the Emir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he stood with all his power in order to try to preserve the human life. Let us take a short break and then we continue inshallah.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So when we look at Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi and him trying to preserve the human life, he even stood against people who threaten other people with death. For example, he never used that method where he put people under the threat of the sword to believe in God, for example, as many others after him did, or before him also did. So he never used that as an excuse to bring people to Islam. Islam never came with a sword. Islam never came with power. Islam never came to force people to, you know, become Muslims. In fact, on the contrary, Islam came to preserve the human life, not shed it, not take it. So you find, for example, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he says himself, "Inna Allah ba'atha Muhammadan nadhiran lil alamin," that Allah send the Prophet as a warner for people, "wa aminan al-tanzil," and a guardian on the message of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, "wa shahidan ala hadhihi al-ummah," and a witness on this nation. And then he says, that's the Prophet. But what was the state of people themselves that the Prophet was sent to them? And he says, "Wa antum ya ma'ashar al-Arab," and for you Arabs, "ala ghayri deen," you have your own religion, "wa fi shar," and you're in evil, doing what? "Tusfukuna dima'akum," you are killing one another. So that's the state. "Wa taqtuluna awladakum," and you kill your own children, because back in the day, the pagans, they used to bury their daughters alive, for example. "وَتَقْطَعُونَ أَرْحَامَكُمْ," and you sever your relations with your kin. So this is the state of people, which means there was no human rights whatsoever before the emergence of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Now the Prophet came. He came as a mercy to end all this bloodshed, not to create his own bloodshed. But sadly, after the demise of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, some of them, they went back to their old paganism and they started shedding blood. But now they're shedding blood under the name of Islam. And sadly, that continues our current day today. You see many terrorist groups under many different names, and they're all shedding blood under the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or by the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They even say Bismillah before they behead a person. Now, is this really Islam? Is this really the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Of course not. So it began after the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and sadly it still continues. So these people, they turn life into a miserable life for people. Like you see some terrorist groups, they take over some countries and people automatically get terrorized. And, you know, things go horribly wrong. And I'm sure you know a lot of examples that I don't want to even mention here. And so Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he says, no, you have to make sure that you work your best, you do your best to preserve the human life, not to take it. And this is just a simple message that we can extract from the words of Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi. We will look more at how he looks at human rights, inshallah, in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Down, it's all right to cry and get help. That's all what a place called the Crying Room tries to tell its visitors in Spain. The Crying Room is part of a building located in central Madrid. It's free and open to the public. The Crying Room aims to remove the stigma attached to mental health, crying and seeking help. It offers a wide range of services, from a corner to crying to a phone with a list of psychologists people can call. Motivating messages are also visible on the walls. People have hailed the initiative, saying it helps them speak out about their negative emotions.
I think it's an excellent idea to visualize the widespread of the mental health issue. And I think it's a really fun take on it, to call it the crying room, because of the Spanish expression, if you want to cry, go to the crying room. So it's kind of stigmatized to cry in Spain, as in many other countries. So I wanted to take part in this this visualization of the problem.
The Crying Room was opened in an effort to raise awareness about mental health and well-being. Official data in Spain show that around 40% of people had symptoms of depression last year. Another 30% experienced anxiety.
First movie in orbit in the making. Two Russian nationals who traveled to the International Space Station to shoot scenes of that movie are now back on Earth. The Soyuz MS-18 spacecraft carrying an actress and a film director undocked from the ISS early Sunday and successfully touched down in Kazakhstan about 3 hours later. The film crew, along with a veteran astronaut, blasted off from the Russian leased Baikonur Cosmodrome earlier this month. They spent 12 days in the ISS to shoot the scenes. The mission beats a Hollywood movie project starring Tom Cruise. The mission adds to a long list of firsts for Russia's space industry. attempts to recreate Vietnamese landscapes. A woman living in the capital, Hanoi, has been doing that for 40 years now. The artist, 61 years old, explains what material she uses to create her artworks.
All the details in my artworks are cut from cloth, which is used for oyai, traditional costume, or cut from silk scarves. These are very small details, and I have to get the whole cloth for oyai. I even have to cut them from beautiful silk scarves sent from my friends abroad.
Took says sometimes hundreds of thousands of pieces of cloth are needed to shape the seams. The cuts should be put together very carefully. Besides that, the woman has to work in a room without any air conditioning, even in the boiling summers of Hanoi. That's because, she says, the pieces of cloth are very tiny and would easily blown away. Her hard work has paid off. The creations sell for up to $5,000. The Vietnamese artist says her work are a summary of the passion and the beauty she has experienced after traveling across her country.
Materials and methods are vital for an artist who combines them to create a masterpiece. Well, a Brazilian artist has used an unusual material to create a huge, dazzling artwork. Mondano has drawn a mural measuring 1,000 square meters using ashes from the burnt Amazon rainforest. The artwork on the side of a building in the city of Sao Paulo depicts a firefighter standing near the scenes of deforestation, blazes, and dead animals. Mondano says he traveled extensively to feel that sadness and, more importantly, to collect ashes from his paintings. He says his aim is to call attention to the environment in his home country, where thousands of wildfires break out each year.
Be the first to catch the balloon. That's what competitors play to win the title at the first Balloon World Cup in Spain. The competition was held in an amusement park in the northeastern city of Tarragona. Participants had to get the balloon to touch the ground before their opponent could touch it. The event was organized by FC Barcelona player Gerard Piqué and a famous web streamer and commentator.
Get out of the comfort zone and try new things. Today we are very proud to have tried something like that and that it has worked so well and that people have enjoyed it. In the end, it's about people having a great time.
The competition was inspired by a trio of American siblings whose balloon game videos had attracted millions of views on TikTok and Instagram. 32 countries competed for the title, and a 18-year-old teenager from Peru became the first world champion of this tournament. He defeated his German rival in a 5-minute final match. For those of you with an extreme fear of needles, this may finally be the good news. A group of Dutch researchers say they are working to create painless needle-free injections. The researchers have developed what they call a bubble gun. The device uses a laser to push tiny droplets through the skin. Take a listen to David Fernandez Rivas, the head of the project, explaining how the process is done within a millisecond.
So within a millisecond, the glass that contains the liquid is heated by a laser. A bubble is created in the liquid, pushing the liquid at velocities on the order of 100 kilometers per hour. And we can see the gelatin, how it penetrates about 1 millimeter approximately.
Now, Rivas says the invention will help ease fear of needles and lower the threshold for vaccinations. He believes the new technology can also prevent the risk of contamination through needles and reduce medical waste. If you're eager to get a needle-free shot, you may still have to wait a few more years before they are made available to everyone. From a voyage aboard a fictional spacecraft to a real-life journey to space, a 19-year-old Canadian actor, known for his portrayal of a starship captain for decades, is now the oldest person ever going to space. After a couple of days of training, William Shatner hitched a ride aboard a suborbital spacecraft on Wednesday. He took off from a Texas desert as a guest, alongside three other passengers, two professionals, and a paid customer. During the 10-minute flight, the team experienced more than 3 minutes of weightlessness. Now, listen to the actor describing the voyage as the most unbelievable experience of his life.
I'm so filled with emotion about what just happened. It's extraordinary. I hope I never recover from it. I hope that I can maintain what I feel now. I don't want to lose it.
During a televised journey, the capsule took its four passengers above the maximum altitude of 100 kilometers, a point where the curvatures of the Earth can be seen. With that, the space captain of the entertainment world also broke a record as the oldest space traveler. Now, many see his experience as the embodiment of the space travel promises he made through decades of acting.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The population of giant pandas in captivity has reached a record high of 673 in 2021. Official data shows this year 48 panda cubs were born, of which 46 survived. Meanwhile, the total number of overseas giant pandas has reached 69. This is the result of joint efforts by Chinese and foreign researchers following decades of caring for the lovely animals. In July, another study put the number of giant pandas living in the wild at over 1,800. The cute bears were then reclassified from endangered to vulnerable. Experts believe such research improves conservation efforts and facilitates monitoring of animal populations. With the help of artificial intelligence, Beethoven's 10th and last symphony is now completed. A group of German musicologists and programmers started the project over a year ago. They analyzed Beethoven's style and then used algorithms to teach a computer to complete the unfinished job. The work was released to mark the 250th anniversary of the prominent musician's birth. The team said they tried hard to solve the puzzle while remaining faithful to Beethoven's process and vision.
I believe that if a composer like Ludwig van Beethoven were to live today, he would probably not only have a large technology team around him to help him, but he would push exactly such technologies and use them for his art. And for me, art is not something that stands fixed in space and is always the same, but that changes with the world, and we can witness that today.
When the German composer died in 1827, he left behind some musical sketches for his 10th symphony. Some experts tried to complete it in the past, but they did not succeed. Researchers in the United States have created an incredibly versatile robot named Leonardo or Leo. Leo was developed by a team at the California Institute of Technology's Center for Autonomous Systems and Technologies. Futuristic robot can walk a tightrope, skateboard, and even fly. Its uniqueness lies in the fact that it uses not just one, but two modes of locomotion. The researchers who developed Leo believe that similar robots will be employed on a wider scale in the future.
I think we're going to see robots like Leonardo with these extraordinary locomotion capabilities used in things like space exploration, because they can overcome very difficult terrain, they can reach hard-to-reach places. But then I think also robots will be more and more in our daily lives. As these robots become more and more robust, more and more reliable, we're going to see them for things like package delivery or helping in the house with daily chores.
Leo is 75 centimeters tall and has four propeller thrusters mounted on his shoulders. While walking, it mimics the movements of a human by using those propellers and a pair of actuated legs. The robot can transition smoothly between flying and walking. Leonardo perceives the world around it with the help of cameras and sensors. Hot air balloons were invented in the 18th century, enabling man to finally fulfill his dream of flying. After more than 200 years, people are still eager to ride the colorful vehicles. Some even use them competitively. In the German hot air ballooning championships, balloonists will fly over the skies of a green Bavarian town of Tegernsee. 25 of Germany's best pilots are vying for first place. The organizers of the event expect a tight race, as the contestants have all managed to pass the previous competitions with flying colors to qualify for the national championship.
A zoo in northeast France has an adorable new inhabitant, a white baby rhinoceros. The cute little male rhino was born on the 6th of October. The zoo staff have given him the name of Mole. He was able to withstand less than 2 hours after being milked. Mole soon started feeding from his gentle 21-year-old mother called Tala. Mole is Tala's third baby.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.